Welcome everybody to this session on vulnerability markets. If you put these keywords into a search engine, you probably get out market vulnerabilities, but not in this combination, but actually it's correct, like I wrote it, vulnerability markets. We're going to discuss about the economic aspects of computer security, and in particular, the economic aspects of vulnerability disclosure, vulnerability discovery. Are there incentives that basically can help to improve software, to give incentives to report vulnerabilities, and so on? Let me start with a motivating example. This is dated December 7th, 2005, already after this talk has been proposed, and it is a very actual example where someone announces and puts for an auction a brand new MS Excel vulnerability. Basically, the guy claimed to provide a tool to create malicious Excel files that can take over the control of the user's PC once he or she clicks the Excel sheet. And the question that will be covered by this talk is this a good practice? And are we going to see more of this? And you're all aware that this topic touches both economic aspects as well as ethical aspects. Let me briefly outline my talk. I think I will first tell you why we study vulnerability markets. Now we'll discuss certain opportunities and risks. Second, I will present you different types of vulnerability markets. And third, discuss some criteria to compare them and to tell which one is better and which one is perhaps not so optimal. So to start with some cheese and other software. What's today's software looking like? It's like Swiss cheese, tons of security holes. And the purpose, the ultimate goal basically is to have secure software, but the intermediate step is basically to fix the holes. And
you can see it very well.
And what are the incentives to fix the holes? Are there any motivations for software vendors, for individuals to report holes that ultimately lead to a fix, to a patch? And finally, the ultimate step is, can we create incentives in a way that people, especially vendors, are motivated to develop secure software from scratch? So you see there's also cheese without holes at all. So can we achieve the same situation for software one day? But before we build more software from scratch, or before we see how we tackle the problem, we have to understand the source of the problem, or the origin. And to answer the question, how can markets help to increase the goals, basically fix the holes or build secure software, we have to see how does the market function or not function right now. And there is already quite a lot of attention in economic aspects of computer security. And there are links from researchers in microeconomics and from computer security experts who jointly do workshops and conferences to study the economic aspects of computer security, because computer security is not only a technical question, but also a question of people about their motivation to implement security, to, well, behave in a secure way. And I will cite two examples from microeconomic theory that directly apply to computer security. I structure them in a supply side and a demand side for computer security. And for supply side, we can cite the well-known story of now Nobel laureate George Akerlof, and he published his story of the lemon market, and lemon is the expression for a used car in American English, and basically uses this example to illustrate the economics of a market with information asymmetry. So what does this mean? Basically means that seller and vendor do not have the same information about the product, so there are hidden qualities, like in a used car, like in a lemon. And if you cannot evaluate, if the buyer cannot evaluate the true quality of a product, then he or she has to assume that it's a bad product. So basically, he is not willing to pay more than the bad product's price. And the same story applies to software security. Since you cannot tell secure software from insecure software apart, since security is not visible, there is no incentive for buyers, for users, to pay more for allegedly secure software. So they are only willing to pay the price of insecure software. The vendors, as a consequence, don't invest in the development of sound security technologies and rather, well, use their budget to implement more visible features or gimmicks. So this is for the supply side. And there's another story for the demand side. The demand side is the tragedy of the commons. It's also an economic theory, well known. I think it's the Allmender problem as well. And the basic rationale behind this is network security is a common good. So you cannot buy security, network security for yourself, but you can only have good network security on a level that is between nodes. So one individual node does not invest into security because the other nodes in the same network would profit from this security, and the individual node, the good example, does not profit because there can still be malicious traffic from the other connected nodes. So in order to solve the problems, all nodes would have to invest, but they don't do so because nobody wants to be the first mover because you don't have an advantage in investing in security. To put it to a point, I mentioned another example, and I think this is much more illustrative. So consider you are... Can you read this? Yeah, okay. Because the contrast is not very well. Consider you're in a restaurant, and you know in advance that the bill is going to be shared. So basically, you have high incentives to order the most expensive dish because you know that the cost is borne by the community and not by yourself. So let's take these two economic theories as an example, and there are many more. But they underline that there is a market failure. So that security, computer and software security, is not provided in an adequate level by the market. The responses or the actions to be taken from both of these sides are quite evident. From the supply side, from the lemon market problem, we see that the consequence must be to make security measurable. And on the demand side, we see that we have to tax or to punish bad security, to give people an incentive to invest into good security. It sounds easier than it is, and there are basically two options to achieve these goals. The first is regulation. Yeah. So it means on the one side to implement standards, to implement best practices. And on the other side, on the taxing-backed security, it basically means, yeah, you should pass a law that fines poorly secured network nodes. And there are really some examples with proposals from economic and law school literature in order to solve this problem. However, regulation is not always the best solution because it is very costly to make the third party, the social planner, really incorruptible. And in addition, it creates more red tape, which is not very desirable, and there are more issues like international harmonization and so on. So the second option would be to let the market regulate the problem itself. So create new market mechanism that basically cure the problems in the existing market. So it sounds like fighting with fire but actually there is some sense behind it. And the answer from the market mechanism point are to make security measurable, we can use the prices, the market prices, as forward-looking indicators. And in the taxing-backed security column, you see that, for example, if you consider cyber insurance, so you can buy insurance policies against cyber threats, then the premiums of insurance could be adjusted by the level of security installed and basically give you a feedback and an incentive to invest in proper security. So this is the topic of this talk, this option B. How can we create market mechanisms that basically solve the ultimate security market failure? And in order to study this topic, we have to study different types of vulnerability markets, because the notion of a vulnerability market is very broad and it is used in many different ways. And the purpose of this second part of the talk is to show you different types of vulnerabilities, to coin terms for them and explain where the differences are. So how does the market look like? It's like a monopoly game. And now let's move around, starting from Go, and looking in the different types, four different types of vulnerability markets. The first one is the one which I call bug challenges and bug auctions. And the idea behind these vulnerability market is that the vendor, the software vendor, offers a monetary reward for bug reports. And you can install this market in a way that you start with a very low reward and increase it over time, so then you can formulate it in terms of a reverse Dutch auction. That's what Andy Osmet once suggested. And in addition, the sum of the reward at a certain point in time is a measure of the security strength of the software. So if the reward for a remote root vulnerability would be $10,000, then it means you can safely use the software to protect $10,000, because an adversary would choose rather to get the reward than attacking your system. And what is important is that this model is financed with the revenue from software sales. And there exist also some real-world examples. I think everybody knows the famous RSA challenge. Mozilla offers, I think, $500 for each severe bug report. And the also very well-known bug challenge for bugs in the tech typesetting systems. The problem with all these types of market is that, first of all, it depends on the financial commitment of the vendor. But if the vendor is not a company, not a institution with sound financial means, then you can't implement this type of market. So this market proposal is useless for open source software. It is, moreover, sorry, yes, there is a question already.
I would contradict that it's useless for open source software because...
Can we put the discussion after this talk, please? Because I think I will deliver the arguments. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, there is an option, but there are more or far better ways to solve the problem. So let's discuss about this afterwards, please. Second problem. I mean, there are examples. For example, Mozilla is one of the real-world examples, which is like an open-source project, but there's a foundation behind, so there are financial means. Second, it is inaccurate for frequent reports, because if you consider that two vulnerabilities are discovered at the same time, a rational bug hunter would report the first one, then the reward is resetted to zero, and if he now reports the second, then he wouldn't earn anything. So basically, he waits until the reward again rises to a level that it is worthwhile to report the bug. And in the meantime, this market is not accurate and the indicator is not accurate at all. And finally, I made the example with these 10,000 bucks, but 10,000 bucks is just for one deployment of the software. And it is absolutely unclear whether the rewards will ever be high enough to back the true risk that is secured with security software. And I think about healthcare and financial institutions, government agencies, and so on. And let me add some more points on user-administered bug auctions. This type of bug auction more or less requires the commitment of the vendor, but the initial example from eBay is what I call a user-administered bug auction. So basically the user finds, or the bug hunter, that's the user here, finds a vulnerability, offers it in an auction to the market, and there are even more problems if you consider this model, because there is no market indicator of the security strength if there is no vulnerability at the moment, because the market price as an indicator does only exist if there is just a vulnerability for sale. And secondly, it is not clear that the vendor actually buys the bug, but it could also be that some third party just buys all bugs simply because they have too much money or they want to monopolize knowledge about bugs and so on. So both vendor and user-administrated bug auctions are far from optimal and suffer from many problems. So let's go to the next type for vulnerabilities, and these are the vulnerability sharing circles, or how I call them, vulnerability brokers. And just let me sketch the business model behind. You have a vulnerability broker, which is a private company, also a public institution, whatever, and that offers money reward for exploits, or call it vulnerability information, plus a non-disclosure agreement. And thus rewards individual bug hunters. This information is further sold to a closed circle of anonymous or, not rather specified subscribers to a, security alert service or to vulnerability sharing circles. And there exist also some real-world examples. There's even some competition which basically drives people to, or these organizations to offer loyalty programs for frequent reports and so on. And I think you can check or read the websites themselves. For example, eDefense were the first, and now Tipping Point with their zero-day initiative followed suit. And the problem with this type of market is basically that you don't know who actually gains the information. It may be users of software, it may be vendors, but it will also be government agencies. So is this really intended? Is it an agent? Is it a good guy or a bad guy? Or it may be even black hats themselves who join these circles and now get this sensitive information. And you might even call this this system like blackmailing the users and the vendors, because you force them to pay a regular subscription to potentially gain some insight in problems in your own products. So let's keep it like this for the second type of vulnerability markets, and go to the third, which is cyber insurance. Cyber insurance, I already sketched it in the introduction or in the first part of the talk, is more or less the fact that you can buy insurance coverage for cyber incidents like privacy violations, security breaches, virus attacks, and so on. And you pay a regular premium to compensate for the risk coverages. Cyber insurance is in general quite desirable because you have benefits on the individual level, so on the firm's level, as well as social benefits. Let's come to the individual benefits, basically with risk pooling. I mean that institutions, firms, users can exchange the uncertain cost of future security events to a fixed expense at the present. So it's basically the insurance principle. You insure your car because you have your health insurance, and you feel safer because you can calculate the costs of future states. It is manageable for companies, and because basically they have these fixed expenses instead of the high volatile expenses, they prevent undue shortages of liquidity and thus avoid crisis. And in addition, the premiums are also an accurate indicator of the security, because you have to imagine that insurance companies charge different depending on what security measures you have in place. So, for example, to get cyber insurance coverage, you have to invest into some sound security technology first. This gives you an incentive to invest, and afterwards you get the coverage for the residual risk. And note that this is basically a measure for the value of security features and not for the cost. So, the cost of a firewall doesn't tell you how good it protects you. On a social level, we have basically all types of incentives to innovate. Basically, since premiums depend on the level of security of a software product or even a hardware product, the manufacturers may opt to invest more in security, because then they know the premiums for my customers will be cheaper, so the total cost of ownership, and this is a buzzword in different contexts, decreases. So it incentivizes manufacturers to produce security or to produce secure software. Second, incentives to implement not only the production of secure software on the supply side is supported, but also the demand side. So basically, people are buying security technology in order to reduce their premiums, and they are also buying this technology in a reasonable level. That means you don't overinvest in security, but you find the optimal trade-off from an economic point of view. And last not least, because insurance companies have a huge interest in knowing more about the nature of computer security and having all possible types of information, also the research in computer security will be funded, and basically insurance companies may do their own research, may basically increase their information situation to keep competitive. Always assume that we have competition in this market. Now let's go to the fourth market type, which I call exploit derivatives. Here again, like with the cyber insurance, you do not trade the information about vulnerabilities directly, but you rather trade or you create an exchange platform for abstract contracts. Contracts that depend or that are derived, that's why we come to the name derivatives, are derived from security events, and a contract could read like this. This contract pays 100 euro to its owner on a specified date if there exists a remote root exploit against a specified software version on a specified platform. Yeah, who would sell or who would buy such a contract? Well, I think I could sell you this type of contract, but not alone, but together in a bundle with the inverse contract. So I sell you both contracts together, bundle the price to 100 euros. So I, as an issuer, do not make any profit, but I don't lose anything either. So both contracts together represent all possible outcomes of future states. So afterwards, the individual participants may opt to use the exchange platform where bids and demands for different contracts are negotiated and prices are quoted to buy and sell one or the other of these contracts. And now let's have a look of who might be the market participants in this case. On the contract that buys in the bad case are bug hunters, yeah, so basically people that find vulnerabilities after they found one. So then they have more information. They, up to a certain level of certainty, know that there is a vulnerability to be reported before the date of maturity, so they can pay more for the contract than the actual market price, and basically they can extract money from their information advantage. Also, commercial users of software products may want to buy this type of contract in order to hedge against financial risks that may occur if the bad state actually materializes. And last not least, the insurance companies, which I've already mentioned before, may want to buy this contract in order to distribute risk to more heads. On the other hand, there is also demand for the inverse contract. Bug hunters, if they made a recent code review, for example, and they consider the code as secure, then they have more information than the market, and they, again, can now use this information to buy this, or basically they value the right-hand contract higher than the actual market price, and they can live from the difference. Investors may want a good yield if these contracts really materialize and if they are used, on the other hand, to hedge the exceptional risks. And last not least, software vendors could use these contracts in two ways. First, if I have a lot of assets in this type of contract, then I underline my security promises that I trust my own software. And I can also use these contracts to compensate my employees, at least part of their salary, in order to give them an incentive to develop secure software, because part of their compensation is regulated by the outcome of the actual security of your product. So let's just have a brief look at a hypothetical chart of this non-existing vulnerability or exploit derivative market. With the time and days here and the quoted mid price for the contract that pays out if there is a vulnerability reported, and you see that it increases over time, and we have several market points. So, for example, if you have rumors about a possible vulnerability, then the market might already react, and because some people might perceive that this software is considered less secure than, for example, other software. And then there is a vulnerability disclosure, but it is not yet clear whether it's exploitable or not. So the market tries to reassess the situation, and it jumps up to almost 90 euros. And finally, you have the last point when the exploit is published, and now it's absolutely sure that one contract will pay and the other not. So the value of this contract is 100 euros. It's also interesting how we can use this information as a measure, if or as a measurement, if we have different versions, so if we issue different contracts for different software versions. Look at this. Let's say the blue line is the English version, whereas the red dotted line is a localization. You see that at the beginning, the localization is considered less secure, and this is we can compute the spread. And the spread between these versions reflects the level of uncertainty, and that comes from the fact that, for example, the localization is not as well examined as the English version or as the standard version, because it is deployed in many more cases and much better in much better monitoring. And you see then afterwards that the level, the spread remains persistent, and it keeps very, very small on the high level, because if one version is exploitable, then the other one is perhaps exploitable as well, if it is nothing particular to the localization. Of course, there are also or still open questions with this type of market with the exploit derivatives. There are unclear points of how the maturity of these contracts should be aligned, how they roll over between different contracts, between different periods. It is not yet clear, for example, how you should organize the market. Is it a market maker market? Is it a bookkeeping market? Is it, well, do you allow the market participants to participate pseudonymously, anonymously, or do they have to identify themselves at least to a third party? And of course, you need someone who, in the end, tests all exploit proposals and announces the result to tell which contract is actually going to pay. But this is a trusted third party that can be controlled and can be distributed if you require that the party publishes everything he or she receives, and then it is easily monitorable. So after discussing these four types of vulnerability markets, we want to have a picture of what are they for, what are the advantages, what are the disadvantages, are there, well, basically, risks and opportunities. To better assess the risks and opportunities, I defined or I stated three possible functions of vulnerability markets and one property. And the functions are information function, incentive function, a risk balancing function, and finally efficiency. Let's have a look at the information function first. You know that the quoted market price, and I already outlined this in the previous slides, is a good indicator of the underlying security situation. And this is already, we have already empirical evidence in the literature that this is the case for existing markets. So there is a number of studies, so-called event studies, that studied or that analyzed the reaction of known common stock markets on announcement of security problems. So there is, for example, the first one was a case study in February 2002, and I think the first three always found a negative impact on market capitalization, but only in the very, very short run, and they looked at the impact of the stock price of the affected firm, whereas the fourth one looked at the impact of the stock price of the manufacturer of the software that has been used by the affected firm, and we see that there is still a significant negative impact, but the impact is not as big as the other one. Note that these estimates are very, very preliminary. They only exist in the very short run, and this is because these stock markets capture a lot of different information and not only security relevant information. So security is only a very, very, very small part in what influences a stock market price. But if we construct vulnerability markets, then those markets are targeted to capture information that is security relevant. So they will deliver much better indicators than, say, the existing stock markets. And then just to go on with this, call it vision, call it crazy example. One day, perhaps, we have this information like a Linux composite vulnerability future index on the top page of our financial journals, because actually it is so important, and you know that finance and a lot of other important economic sectors depend entirely on computer security. And this is just to illustrate the information function. Let's go to the next function. The next function is the incentive function. Now, here we go back to the Swiss cheese. We have to study two types of motivations. The first is, does the market create motivation for individuals to hunt bugs, to find bugs, and to report them? Already today, a lot of bugs are reported in their respective media and respective mailing lists and so on. But what are the incentives? Now you have altruism, you can call it reputation incentives, but if you add a monetary reward, there might be even more. And also, if you add a monetary reward, there might be a small or at least a not negligible chance to convert people who now opt to sell to the black market to sell to the white market, and so basically increase transparency and let the general public benefit. And there is a second type of motivation, and this is the motivation for developers. So that's a market mechanism. Create motivations or incentives for software developers to invest in the development of security, of proper security mechanisms. And now there is only one type of possible motivation. This is the long-term trust of satisfied customers. So you promise them, I buy a secure product, and perhaps the customer decides again for me when he buys the next computer in 5 to 10 years. But if you add advantages from vulnerability markets, you can add incentives in short-term profits from competitive advantage, and this is a much stronger incentive for decision-making in corporate businesses than just this long-term perspective. So this is what I call the incentive function. A third function is the risk balancing function. And to illustrate what I mean with the risk balancing function, let's look at an example case with two possible outcomes. We have an uncertain future, and there is the possibility for a good state. So basically, the pirate is blind, he does not target your goal, or the bad state, where the adversary manages to capture your information. And now let's do some accounting stuff. Here are the figures. So consider we have a revenue of 1,000 euros, and in the good state it remains 1,000 euros. Whereas if we have a revenue of 1,000 euros and we have information security losses in the value of given, say, 2,000 euros, we come out with a total of minus 1,000. That's quite easy. But if we add a possible vulnerability market, we could invest in 20 exploit derivatives that pay if the software breaks. So the costs are expenses here, minus 20 euros, and I get, in the good state, no return from these derivatives. So I reduce my overall outcome to 980 euro, but it is still positive, and it's only a small reduction. Whereas on the other side, if the bad state really materializes, then I have the same expenses, but the derivatives pay me 2,000 euros, which exactly compensate the losses from my information security exposure, and I end up with the same total. So this is a way to balance my risk with the existence of vulnerability markets. And this is why I consider the risk balancing function as an also very important function that has to be, basically we have to look closely at every possible type of vulnerability market, whether it offers the risk balancing function. And finally, it's come to the property which I call efficiency, and I don't want to go into so many details, but it is clear that vulnerability markets can only fulfill these functions if they are efficient in a way that there are low transaction costs. And so basically you don't have to pay a lot in order to participate in the market, because then you have a huge number of market participants. And the more participants you have, the better is it to find a counterpart if you want to do a certain deal that basically reflects in the liquidity of the market. Also, transparency is a very important property. Basically, it means that there are fair rules that are regarded, that the market prices are quoted publicly, because only if they are quoted, they are valid indicators. And finally, that all market participants are very accountable, so that the risk that your counterpart just defaults if you want to get his funds is minimal. And this is the efficiency property. So putting everything together, the four or five possible types of vulnerability markets measured by the four functions and properties gives this matrix. And this matrix is not something very final. It's more like an initial point for discussion, and I try to value qualitative arguments for each of these combinations and to foster a discussion on how accurate how accurate this assessment is and how well different types of vulnerability markets do. You see that all markets create a kind of incentives, but some are suboptimal in other functions. Cyber insurance, for example, is weaker in the information function because the prices are not negotiated continuously and also not necessarily disclosed publicly. Cyber insurance is also a little bit inefficient because of high transaction costs, and there remains a residual risk because it is very difficult in cyber insurance cases to substantiate your claim. But on the other hand, cyber insurance is complementary to derivative markets because, as I already told, cyber insurance companies want or may want to buy exploit derivatives in order to hedge their risks, which they accumulate in the cyber insurance policies. Derivatives, on the other hand, are a little bit worse in risk balancing because it's very difficult to manage the optimal portfolio when the payouts are defined by global events rather than if you can get the compensation for your individual risks or for your individual claims like it is in the insurance case. So consider this as a starting point, and I would be very grateful if I receive constructive comments on this. So this is only, once again, an ad hoc evaluation. So the remaining question is, why do we not start to implement vulnerability markets or the good types of vulnerability markets today, and or why don't they exist right now? And let's consider the situation that we have exploit derivatives. So we basically would need to build a distributed market platform, issue some contracts. As I told you, it's quite easy to issue contracts apart from legal obstacles, okay? And, who is the third party? Why not the CCC or others? I mean, you can distribute it. There are two main problems which I see right now. Perhaps you see more. The first one, it's very difficult to start these markets small, because at the very beginning, the publicity impact of these test markets is much higher than the financial impact. And this basically means that big players, like big software monopolists, may opt to influence the market while accepting losses. So they they can basically pay back some of what's happening with the lighting situation in this room. Total control. You see, they already influence the market here. So the first obstacle of why not implementing today is you can't, or it's very difficult to get accurate information and to get a functioning market if you start in a small scale. And the second one is, and I think this is more serious, is that if you decide to implement one of these markets, or especially the exploit derivatives, then you enforce a policy of instantaneous full disclosure. And full disclosure is highly controversial. It is not fully accepted among the security community. And there are good arguments for and against, and basically the ultimate argument of full disclosure, or yes or no, is do we believe that the supply of vulnerabilities is unlimited or not? If there are infinitively many vulnerabilities in software, then it does not help to find some of them, because the overall risk of being attacked does not reduce. If, however, we believe that software has, or at least that the vulnerabilities in software are ranked, so you have bigger ones, more visible ones, and other ones that are, more hidden, not exploitable, whatever. If we believe this, then it can be reasonable to implement or to enforce at least a certain kind of full disclosure, because then you make you fix these vulnerabilities or the severe vulnerabilities first, and you even have to implement full disclosure in order to warn the users, because the risk of independent rediscovery of the vulnerability is not negligible. So there is already some empirical work done. It is also of preliminary nature, but I don't want to hide it here, and this is data that has been collected by Andy Osmet again. And he evaluated the number of independent reporters cited in Microsoft security bulletins. And you see for each year here how many reports credited no, one, two, or three independent organizations that reported the vulnerability. And from this data, we can compute the risk of rediscovery, and you see that it is at an ample amount of, say, 7% on, or even almost 8% on average. So 8% of the vulnerabilities have been discovered independently in a fairly short window of rediscovery. It's only 3 months, so if you consider the whole life cycle of a software, it could be even worse. So just to give you some data, to give you the reasons behind the argument, this is evidence for full disclosure, but there are also people claiming the opposite. To conclude this talk, we have seen that vulnerability markets are tools. Tools, not ends. Tools to measure the software quality, information function, to reward good information security, incentive function, and to hedge financial risks. This is the risk balancing function. And we have to learn to distinguish. Vulnerability markets are not all the same. There are better variations, but those barely exist in practice. And what is absolutely clear, the take-home message more or less, is that a mere zero-day trading, like the eBay example cited at the beginning, create adverse effects. They are not welfare-maximizing strategies at all. And last but not least, this is an invitation to discuss and to reason. I think the main purpose of this goal was to foster a constructive debate and to just give some terminology so that people are talking about the same things with the same names, because now we have only a broad concept of vulnerability markets, and different people talk about different things if they call it vulnerability market. And in the end, there is no ultimate solution, but vulnerabilities or vulnerability markets are not that bad as they are sometimes reported or perceived. So let me close with this, and I appreciate your questions. of testing exploits in the end. Was that your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you have basically what you have transaction costs in any market. That's why it is important that the market is big. If you start with a small market, then you have the same fixed transaction costs and you can divide it by only a small number of participants. Whereas if you start small, if you start larger, then the cost distributes almost equally and you're very, very well off. And in the end, if you look at the assets at stake in information security, then the cost of testing should not be in any relevant size compared to the positive outcomes of vulnerability derivatives. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Speak loud, I will repeat it.
If there we go, the question. Whoa, test. The question is how it's a bit complex. You're approaching the vulnerability society or whatever from a marketing perspective or with an economy. You're taking an economy view. What about a way of thinking that applies or is more similar to open source or someone not wanting to be a part of more economic systems or more market-oriented economic systems in the world? I think it sounds like a good idea personally, but still, I know there are, or I can imagine that there will be doubters.
Yeah, I can imagine this as well, and I think it's a very good question. I would not call it a marketing approach, but rather a microeconomic approach. Yes, you say open source is more or less the contrary to market. And basically what I propose is more market, and we see from open source that less market is more successful. Is that, was that your point? Yeah, okay.
The question is if there has been any thought of going in another direction, having an organization of vulnerability
regulations,
okay. Regulation, yeah. that isn't taking an economical approach.
I mean, regulation is also a political or economical approach, and I would say even open source is an economic approach, because open source is the economic response to the monopoly on the supply side for software, because what you have is not the free market, which I propose here, but what you have is no competition. It is basically a monopoly. It is an imperfect market, and a response to an imperfect market, like in a software sector, is giving or offering software at the market price, and the market price is zero, open source, because there are no marginal costs for software. You can redistribute different copies of software for free or for zero cost. Yep. So it's clear that the price in a competitive environment falls to zero. So I would not say that open source is the contrary to economic approaches, but it's more a creation of economic reason.
Yeah, fair enough. It doesn't necessarily have to be hung up on open source, just I think I was more interested in something else than an economical approach.
Yeah, but what is else? I mean, else means regulation, means building a government, building someone whom you trust, whom you report everything, who is tax-funded, and basically you have to assume that this is not a bad guy.
I agree. I just, the question...
And this is the alternative, yeah, sure.
The what I was throwing up in there was a question is if there has been any work
the question is whether there is work. As I cited, there is this seminal work by Campbell and Jean Chomp. I think she both proposed a tax disincentive. I don't know how to skip fast. They proposed a way to tax or to punish insecure nodes and to implement state regulation to get the security in order. Well, it is up to the individual belief which one is the better solution, but yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you for your answer and comments anyway.
More comments and questions? Yes.
No, I want first to stress that I think you did a very good talk and you have very interesting ideas. Nevertheless, I have to nitpick at some places. The first point is, I actually think that the information value of bug challenges is much better than you gave it. I hope so, because actually that is what I'm suggesting to improve security in the German Gesundheitstelematik. But we can talk if you have a better suggestion for that problem. I think so because the value of what is given as a reward if you show this bug is actually a good security measure. So if you have a bug challenge which say, well, if you find a bug in the system under these conditions, you will earn 10 million euro, then I think that is a quite strong...
Do you actually offer rewards in the range of 10 million euros? Because the rewards I know are about $500. Yeah, or for example, the bug auction was $60 before it has been canceled.
I'm working the other way around. I'm talking about critical infrastructure for the German medical system. And I'm working the market in this way, the other way around, because I say, if they want to put this on the citizens by doing regulation, then they have first to prove that it's secure enough, and they have to prove this by raising such a high reward for finding a bug. That is my approach, which is
if you
reversing
really
the sense of comparison.
I endorse this approach if you have the means to really have adequately high rewards.
No, I'm requiring... Just a second. I'm requiring, before a system is introduced for all German citizens,
I
require that there must be a bug challenge with a very high reward.
Okay, so I think the ECCC will not have any problems to finance the next Congress.
Yes, definitely, yes. Yeah. With the future market, I see some ways it can be manipulated. One would be the vendor of a software can buy all the bundles. That will cost him only the transaction cost, and he can suppress actually the market functioning.
The supply of bundles is infinitive, because you basically everybody can issue bundles. And,
okay. That's good.
It's not limited. No.
Yeah,
I mean, bundles are issued depending on demand. So, for example, even I show different contracts. For example, the one for the localized version and the normal version. And you have different platforms. You have different software. So it will be a huge number of different contract bundles, and it is only controlled by demand. So everybody can issue because it's absolutely risk-free to issue this bundle.
Yeah, that's countering that approach. The other risk I would see is that if a financially strong vendor starts buying negative contracts of a competition.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, he can, what is the English word? It's a kind of innuendo attack. Yeah, he's attacking the goodwill and the good name of his competition. That would be an
But he's paying a high price. He or she is paying a high price.
No, actually not, because he's more or less. If the value of these is low, which means the security fame of his competition is high, then he's paying a low price. But he has a cheap attack.
Okay. There's a contradiction, because if he or she pays a low price, it basically means it does not endanger the reputation of the competitor, because if it is a low price, that basically means there's no market impact of buying the competitor's contracts. If there is some market impact, basically what you want to do is to buy the contracts of your competitor in order to raise the price so that the public thinks this is less secure, but then you have to pay more and more higher prices. And
I'm not talking about theory. This is happening...
Sorry, what do you mean?
Exactly.
You will always have certain level of speculation in any market, and we know that markets sometimes are. And the question is to balance the trade-offs. But it's very difficult to beat existing markets in the long run. I agree with you that in the short run there are kind of bubbles, and we will perhaps see security market bubbles. It's a disadvantage, and I don't know any mechanism to prevent this. Well, of course, perhaps more transparency and requiring certain restrictions in the market. Who knows? This is, I wouldn't call it a weak point, but it's natural with any type of market. And if the advantages outweigh the cost, then yeah.
Yeah, I still say it's a good idea, but we see effects like this in the stock market. We see I think 2 years ago we had exactly an attack which worked in the real stock market like this.
Sure, I mean, especially if the markets are concentrated, if someone has huge market power. And I think there's also, you can look in the paper, I already mentioned this problem of market imperfections, but it simply was too short in this talk to go into all details.
The third problem I see is a compensation. It should be prevented that a user of a software can overcompensate his losses, because then he has no incentive to use or to make his software installation more secure, because he would earn more if a bug is found. Yeah. If in your example he buys 40 certificates instead of 20, then he would have an advantage if a bug is found. He would earn more money with a bug than without the bug.
Yeah, but then he's entering different business. Then he or she is entering the business of vulnerability hunters. And sure, you're not forbidden to invest into failure of software. I mean, if you look at, in practice, we have, for example, weather derivatives. And that's basically what organizers of big open-air events use in order to hedge the risk of bad weather, of rain. And there you also do not forbid to buy more bad weather contracts than good weather contracts, or than required to compensate for his possible losses, because then he or she is entering different business. I mean, then he speculates on rain. Fine. Sorry, perhaps I didn't get your concern.
You claimed that the derivatives are quite good at giving an incentive to make software secure.
Yes.
And on a basic level, I understand that. But the derivative, actually, you can earn money with it when you know more about the security level, when you know more than the public knows.
Exactly.
That's when you can really earn money with it.
Exactly.
That would mean, if I'm a programmer in such a company, I would build in a difficult-to-detect backdoor, which I know. And that's, of course, not helping security, you know.
That's why I propose to use it as part of compensation. And, of course, yes, there are dangers of conflicts of interest, because this is nothing else than a typical conflict of interest. But we have this type of conflicts of interest in any market that is existing right now. And we know how sort of dealing with. Sure, there may be imperfections as well. But I think we have a huge tradition and experience in dealing with conflicts of interest within a company.
But you agree that the scenario would work?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you can also read on this in the paper. So it's already covered. Yeah. That was the last question? Okay, thank you very much.